Happy Memorial Day weekend, everybody. Yes, I know, time does not feel real in quarantine, but it's true. The Healthcare Happy Hour is taking this week off in light of the long weekend, but we encourage you to listen again to Marcy, John, and Chris discuss the Heroes Act, which passed the House on May 15th, ushering a new round of bipartisan negotiations in the Senate. But before that, I also want to tell you about the NIHU COVID-19 Relief Fund. Through the NIHU Education Foundation, our COVID-19 Relief Fund has been initiated to provide financial support to NIHU members and their families that have been most impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. Financial support could provide monetary assistance with out-of-pocket medical expenses, unanticipated funeral expenses, or other special circumstances. You can donate to the fund or apply for assistance yourself at NIHU.org. Have a great weekend.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us for the NIHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. Before we begin, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify. The podcast is distributed on these platforms every Friday and is included in NIHU's weekly member-exclusive health policy newsletter, The Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour.
We apologize for the audio quality on this week's episode of the Healthcare Happy Hour. We are practicing social distancing and recording in our individual homes.
Earlier this week, House Democrats unveiled their proposed next phase in the federal coronavirus response, the Health and Economic Recovery Omnibus Emergency Solutions Act, or HEROES Act. At the same time, the IRS released new guidance that addresses some of the Section 125, FSA, and HSA requests that NIHU made in our list of suggestions to the administration last month. On this week's episode of the Healthcare Happy Hour, Marcy, John, and Chris discuss this latest legislation and regulation. The HEROES Act is yet another massive trillion-dollar piece of legislation meant to stimulate the economy in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. Can you talk about some of the major provisions included in this bill?
Well, there's a great deal in this bill. Not all of it will survive a final enactment. It's largely a Democratic effort, very partisan. They've thrown in a lot. Speaker Pelosi has spoken to her various factions within the conference, and there's things in here that appease progressives and moderates alike. But there are provisions in here that we do care about.
Yeah, I think today we're not going to try to cover everything in the bill because it is a $3 trillion bill, and that's a lot to cover. But today, let's focus on what NIHU cares about. Today, there's a lot of healthcare-specific things in this piece of legislation. So not everything in the bill is economic stimulus. It is things like contract tracing and assistance for programs to that extent. The bill does provide a 100% funding of COBRA. COBRA, as we know, is expensive because the individual ends up paying their portion, the employer portion, and an admin fee. This would provide 100% coverage, so people would be able to stay on their employer plans. I think this is particularly useful for people who will be going back to their jobs. So many people have been furloughed or laid off during this pandemic and economic recession, but expect to come back when the offices are open again and when the businesses are open again. And so this will be a good way of keeping people on their health insurance plan and not losing that. And at 100% coverage, this is also something that's not going to add the financial burden onto employers. So this is something NIHU has supported. We are very supportive to see that in there. Marcy can go into some of the concerns we have on the regulatory side of COBRA, because we do have some concerns about what's come out on regulations and the burden on employers. But we think this is a much better solution than only providing partial funding. In the 08 economic downturn, the federal government provided 65% of coverage for COBRA. What we saw with that is either poor take-up rates for individuals because they still had to come up with the other 35%. We also found a very large burden on employers on administering all those benefits without any assistance.
What Chris is referring to is the regulatory side, and I think the provisions in this House bill. And as John mentioned, it is a House Democrat bill. So we do expect some negotiation around this, although we do expect support for subsidizing COBRA at a high level, whether it's 100 or goes to 90 or 95%. But that COBRA subsidization would go a long way to help with many of our concerns from the COBRA guidance that came out about 2 weeks ago. And that was the guidance that extended the eligibility period to 60 days beyond the declaration of the end of a national emergency. So it really broadens out the time frame that an employee could decide to elect COBRA. It also suspends payment for COBRA at that time. So there are a lot of concerns about what happens at the end of the national emergency, and folks have decided to elect COBRA, didn't make their payments, now their payments are due. How and who is that going to affect? Where is it going to fall for the claims that were incurred during that time? Will the consumer be responsible for all of those payments? And as we know, COBRA can be very expensive. Will this be something that falls back onto the employers to be responsible for those pieces? So knowing that Congress is looking at funding this at such a high level, I think will really ease a lot of the concerns that we had, at least on the funding aspect of this, not necessarily some of the other concerns about possibly leading to adverse selection with this extension of the eligibility period, concerns that folks, because COBRA is expensive, won't elect unless they do end up getting sick. So hopefully with a COBRA subsidization as high as we're looking at here at 100% or negotiated down to 90, the hope there is that healthier folks will go ahead and elect COBRA because it is subsidized at such a high rate so that we won't fall into that possibility of having only the sick electing and only doing it when they do get sick, because there is such a long extension of the eligibility period for folks to decide to go onto COBRA. And we will have a letter put together on the other extensive list of concerns that we have with the COBRA guidance that we'll be able to share with you all next week.
So back to this bill, you're probably listening to this podcast and going, well, why does anyone care? Because the Senate isn't going to pass that. But it's really important that we shape provisions that we do care about in the way that Marcy and Chris have described. It also does not have a provision that says it's credible coverage. And we know that a number of older people will elect COBRA and won't be returning to work and will go into Medicare and then have a 10% penalty for life. And so we would like to see that added to the bill to take care of that issue once and for all. But I think it's really important that we continue to have these conversations on those provisions that we do care about.
One of the pieces of this bill that we do care about is the section on flexible spending arrangements, or FSAs, and allowing those that have an FSA that is active during 2020. We know not all of the FSA plans are a calendar year, so depending on your plan year, but allowing folks to carry over more than the usual amount and allowing for folks to even carry over their FSAs for a longer time into the grace period, longer than what is normally allowed. And I'll talk in a few minutes about some of the guidance that the IRS released and some notices this week that do touch on FSAs, but by far not as encompassing as the provisions that are in this proposed bill. And just give you an example, it would allow participants to carry over up to $2,750 in unused benefits or contributions from 2020 to 2021. And for these, it also allows those on dependent plans to do so as well for their unused dependent care assistance benefits. So this would go a long way in helping folks that have put funds into their FSA, but aren't using them right now because of the restrictions on elective procedures or even just not taking advantage of their regular visits. And so since they're not using that money, they really shouldn't lose it, like with typical FSAs at the end of their plan year. So this is something that we've been asking for quite some time. So we're very optimistic to see this in that House version of this bill. And from what we've heard, and John and Chris, you can touch on this, we don't think that this is something that's going to become a partisan debate. So we are hoping to see this in the final package.
Yes, this is the sort of provision that while this is a House Democratic bill, I believe that Republicans have also been very supportive of. And so as negotiations go on with the Senate and this $3 trillion bill probably gets pared down quite a bit, this FSA rollover provision that is much wider and more vast than the regulatory guidance, I'm really very hopeful makes it into a final COVID package that both the House and the Senate and Democrats and Republicans can support.
What other provisions are included in the HEROES Act?
Keep in mind, this is an 1,800-page bill. The summary of the bill was 90 pages. So this really encompasses a long list of things that the House Democrats would like to see pushed through. There is more funding for some of the programs that we've seen that were established under the Families First Act and then the First CARES Act. Some folks, even though this is the HEROES Act, are referring to it as CARES 2.0, or that is what the final version of this package will be. And so there are extensions for unemployment compensation. There are extensions for Paycheck Protection Program, the PPP loans, extension for funds for the emergency assistance loans, a few changes for FMLA. So really looking at what was provided earlier and trying to make some tweaks to some of those pieces while also trying to move forward with new provisions. And then also looking at trying to make sure that it's very clear who is able to receive these funds and extending the time frame for the loans. So as you all know, the PPP loans were for 8 weeks and we're several weeks in now. And it's very evident that many of these businesses are going to need assistance for a longer term. So this will allow for an extension through August of 2020. It also looks to ways that they can better fund some of the smaller banks to be able to provide these loans. Again, from the experiences with the first round of PPP, many businesses were only able to work through some of the larger banks to access these loans. But in many rural areas, or even in some of the urban areas, if a business is working with a smaller bank, they're more likely to be able to get any type of loan from that bank because that's who they've been working with. So having to go to a larger bank that they don't have a lending history with was very burdensome and a barrier for some folks to be able to access these loans. So there are some provisions that will help on that side as well to allow for some of these smaller banks to be able to provide the loans and also feel reassured that the funds are there. Something that I think may not end up in the final package is a special enrollment period that they're opening up on the marketplace. President Trump announced that they would not be opening up the federal marketplaces for a special enrollment period for COVID-19. We did have a number of states that run their own marketplaces that opened up different time frames, whether it was 2 months or having to prove that you were affected by COVID-19 to be able to enroll, different qualifications. But in this bill, it allows for a 2-month special enrollment period on the federal marketplace. Here, I think we could see some opposition to this on the Republican side just because the marketplaces are so tied to the ACA, and it's very difficult for anything to get bipartisan support if it even has a hint of changing the ACA.
The House Democrat bill also codifies into law what the administration did on surprise billing. The current surprise billing provisions only deal with COVID-related cases, but make sure that the consumer is held harmless and cannot get a surprise bill from the hospital. This gives it a little more teeth by putting it in the law and makes it enforceable. We do think provisions like this will probably move forward. However, it's not the comprehensive solution for surprise billing that we are hoping for. And I also have concerns that while it holds the consumer harmless, it doesn't really fix the dispute between the insurance carrier and the hospital. And so those sorts of disputes will still have to be worked out, but the consumer will be held harmless for any COVID-related bills.
So what do the politics behind this bill look like? What would Democrats need to do to get Republicans on board?
Well, I think right now what the Democrats are doing is laying out a marker of what they would like to see the bill look like. This bill is introduced in the House. We're recording this on Thursday. We're expecting a vote on Friday in the House. Expect it to be largely along party lines, with maybe only a couple members crossing the aisle to vote the other way. And I think this sets up for a longer-term negotiation for the next bill. On the Senate side right now, Mitch McConnell is claiming he only really wants to work on the employer liability question, and he really wants to see how the economy is working overall and making decisions on some of these other things much further down the line. In the meantime, the Senate will spend their time confirming judges to the court system. So I do think this is a negotiation over the long run of some sort of employer liability provisions. And I think there's a lot to be decided on how vast versus narrow those employer liability provisions. And then the Democratic priorities here that we were discussing when it comes to funding of COBRA or some of these stimulus provisions that we were not able to discuss here. The bill is $3 trillion large. I doubt anything that Mitch McConnell would agree to would be anywhere near close to that amount of money. And so I think they're setting up positions to head towards a longer-term negotiation. And while these negotiations are going on, I think it's important for NAHU and our members and employers to highlight the pieces of the House Democratic bill that we really support, such as the COBRA coverage and the FSA rollovers, because pieces of the House bill will be jettisoned and put aside. We want to make sure that our pieces that are important to us make it into the final package.
There's a lot of Republican support for working on state and local relief. And so I think there will be a meeting of the minds in early June, which isn't that far away. So I think, like Chris said, this is really just a marker bill. It's going to be along party lines. There's also some support for allowing proxy voting, which is a very contentious move. But I mention this because this is going to come first ahead of the actual vote. So this is already going to anger a lot of people on the Republican side, but there is some support for proxy voting because there are a lot of very nervous people about actually coming back to Washington, which is still under quarantine until June 8th. But having said that, there will be a negotiation and another bill at some point, probably in early June.
And one thing I wanted to point out that Chris mentioned about the Senate and McConnell focus on having some judges approved and appointed, it's very, very important, especially with some of the judges in the districts that are being appointed here. Many of them are the judges that are going to hear many of the lower court cases that we all will be following for quite some time, all of those healthcare issues that go through the court system. So it's very important that we think about that and who is in power when the appointments are happening, who is referring them to the Senate to be confirmed. And so these will be, for a large portion, a number of Republican justices that will be joining the benches. And so that does kind of color things moving forward when you think about some of these cases that we'll be seeing in the future.
Moving on to the new IRS guidance. What do these new notices establish, and how do they relate to the suggestions we made to the administration last month?
So earlier this week, actually the same day that those 1,800 pages of text from the House Democrats came out, we had two notices released by the IRS to provide guidance specific to Section 125 cafeteria plans and the use of FSAs. Some of this guidance directly answers some of the questions that we raised in our letter to the administration that we submitted at the beginning of April about the treatment of Section 125 plans, the availability for them to change plans mid-year without going through the traditional notice requirements, and then also the ability of carrying over for FSAs beyond the grace period for their plan year. And I know we talked a little bit about that earlier in this podcast for what was included in the House bill. And that by far goes to, I think, what the ideal would be for how we could see FSAs carrying over. The IRS guidance, however, is a bit more restrictive. So for the IRS guidance, it allows for folks with Section 125 plans to extend claims periods to apply unused amounts remaining in an FSA or dependent care assistance program for expenses that were incurred during that plan benefit year for qualified benefits through December 31 of 2020. So if you have funds in your FSA that are left over at the end of the year and you go into your grace period, you can use those past the end of your plan year, but it has to be for claims that were incurred during the plan year. It also extends the ability of taxpayers to make mid-year elections for health coverage. So if you decide that you do want to enroll in an FSA, to enroll in a dependent care assistance program, and allow to respond to any needs that have changed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And again, it kind of relaxes some of the notice requirements, but the guidance is not very specific, but it says that in order to allow an enrollee to change their status, it has to be to better themselves. So they're really trying to make sure that folks aren't reducing the type of plans that they have, but only enhancing it. And again, the language there was very loose. So it is not as specific as we would like it to be there, but it does allow people, if they want to contribute more to their FSAs, they're able to do that. If they would like to add a spouse or a dependent onto their plan, it allows them to do that mid-year. It also allows someone who may not have taken up their employer-sponsored plan to be able to actually enroll mid-year for their Section 125 plans. It also allows for someone, if they feel that they have better coverage from a spouse and the spouse's employer-sponsored coverage, for them to be able to end their coverage and go onto their spouse's plan. So a lot of flexibility that normally would not happen in the middle of the year. It also allows, if you have a high deductible health plan, for your FSA to cover expenses related to telehealth services retroactive to January 1 of 2020. So this is for services that typically aren't covered under telehealth, but because of the pandemic, you are kind of forced to use telehealth for those different services. So it allows you to use those FSA funds for that, where previously that wouldn't have been allowed. Then finally, for the carryover for FSA funds, it does allow an increase for carryover at 20% of the allotted amount for carryover. The allotted amount is $500, so it increases at 20%, which is a maximum of $550. And it adjusts annually based on inflation, so it will increase over the years. And that's something that does allow a small increase in the carryover moving forward, so that's good. However, that amount is not really what we had in mind when we suggested increasing the amount that folks could carry over, because they're not using their FSAs as much during this time. So we do prefer the language in the House bill that allows almost $3,000 to be carried over. And so that's why we're optimistic about seeing that in the House bill. But we are happy to see that they have increased the carryover, even if it's just by 20%. It is a good indication that these are some of the things that they're looking at possibly building on, or kind of hinting towards Congress that they need broader action from Congress to cover them, to be able to allow for some of those larger changes going forward this year.
What other guidance or clarification would NAHU like to see from the federal agencies on these matters?
Well, we've seen kind of two waves of guidance and notices from the federal agencies on issues that we requested action on. We do still have some pieces that are left on our long list. Many of those are in relation to employers and employer reporting. With the guidance that came out a couple of weeks ago, prior to the IRS guidance that I was just talking about, there was some relief on employers, but specific to things like filing their forms 5500 and others, but there weren't the technical pieces of relief for things like distributing your 1095 and delays for response to 226J letters. There was more of this broad stroke at the end of the guidance of employers using their best judgment for compliance where there may not be availability at the time, but it was just not enough cover, I think, for employers to feel as though they truly won't be held responsible later on or be penalized later on for late filings and things like that. So we would really like to see some specific wording on that And I think that's where we have our kind of two-prong approach of working not just with the agencies, but with Congress as well. We do know that the agencies are a bit more nimble and can work quickly in some cases to address some of our concerns. But at the same time, for some of these larger pieces and the larger action, we do need the action of Congress on those measures. And that's why it's so important that we stay engaged both with the federal agencies and with members of Congress.
It is now time for the NAH2 Healthcare Happy Hour Toast of the Week. Who are we toasting to this week?
This week, we are toasting to our NAHU members, specifically those working with employers and getting them through this tough time with all of the different pieces that we discussed on the podcast today and new guidance that they have to keep up with. We know that this is an extraordinary time, and we toast to you for keeping up with all of this guidance and assisting your employer clients and helping them to maintain or obtain health insurance coverage.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NAHU's government affairs efforts or to become a member, visit NAHU.org.